rather go. I'm going to float. We're going to get started now.
I would say don't panic.
Welcome, everyone. I'd like to convene the meeting of the board. At this time, I ask the secretary to please call the roll.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cepeda.
Here.
Mr. Dale.
Here.
Ms. Dawood.
Present.
Mr. Edwards.
Here.
Mr. Estrada. Ms. Holmes.
Here.
Ms. Jacobson.
Here.
Dr. King.
Here.
Mr. McMillan.
Here.
Mr. Mitchell.
Here.
Ms. Panic.
Here.
Governor Pritzker. Ms. Smart.
Here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dee Dee. All right, at this time, I'd like to welcome everyone to the July 2019 Board of Trustees retreat. And I'd also like to welcome our new student trustees who actually will be formally installed at our meeting tomorrow. I'm going to get these names pronounced wrong, I'm sure, but I will try. Rosie Dawood from UIS from Springfield, Susan Panic from right here at UIC in Chicago, and Trayshawn Mitchell from Urbana, who I might note is serving his third tour of duty as student trustee. So welcome, everyone.
Just can't get enough. Please.
This year, for our retreat, we have a planned discussion on three important issues that impact higher education: a culture of integrity and excellence, fostering healthy relationships across our campuses, and ensuring environmental and financial sustainability. The goal is to develop ideas that can be used to form an outline for a written guidepost on each of these topics, meant to serve the system as a statement of our values going forward. Mr. President, have I captured that accurately?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
President Killeen, would you please share some opening comments and introduce our invited guests?
I'd be delighted to. Thank you, Chairman Edwards. First, I'd like to welcome all colleagues from the U of I, and it's wonderful to see you all participating in this. It's with great pride that we participate today in a collaborative process of identifying critical issues that affect us all in higher education and the core tenets that unite us at the University of Illinois system in responding to these matters into the future. 2 years ago, in July 2017, we devoted our annual Board of Trustees retreat to the contemplation of three topics: free speech, globalization and immigration, and civic engagement, and the drafting of principles to guide us in dealing with each of these issues. Then, as today, we convened 100 people, trustees, students, faculty, staff, top leaders of our system's universities, and external experts in a vibrant and substantive discussion among three working groups. Broad-based guiding principles were drafted on each topic, and dozens more people, faculty, students, trustees, and staff also collaborated to review the drafts and provide valuable input. Within a few months, we produced what I hold here, that I hope you all have, and which can be found on our website, a guiding principles document. A quick, short read, but one that really, truly reflected the impulses of our trustees and our staff and faculty. And it's proven to be successful, a timely and valuable document in certain circumstances, a Midwest modest voice, authentic, and it's helped inform our decisions and public statements since then. We said then, 2 years ago, that these are living documents to be adjusted as needed to accommodate change or to incorporate new issues involving the core values that guide us. And so we're assembled here today to consider three additional topics: integrity and excellence, healthy relationships across our campuses, environmental and financial sustainability, and with an outstanding panel of invited subject experts and breakout discussion facilitators. And as I said, in 2017, we can be proud of what this inclusive process says about the strength and cohesiveness of the University of Illinois system. And we should be proud of what the results say about the seriousness with which we fulfill our responsibilities. I would like to emphasize that we want these reports or statements to be timeless in nature, not to respond to any event or particular circumstance that we might foresee. And I'd like to give a quick little story about Illinois with a quote to illustrate what I mean by timeless statements of authentic values. In 1820, I'm a bit of a history buff, so please give me some indulgence here. In 1824, way before Lincoln. State Senator Joseph Duncan of Jackson County, a veteran of the ugly war of 1812 and a future governor, the only Whig governor ever for the state of Illinois, introduced 29-year-old the Act for the Establishment of Free Schools in Illinois. It was the most far-reaching education legislation in the Western United States since the Northwest Ordinance of 1789, which declared that, as you know, schools and the means of education shall be forever encouraged in the Western territories. The governor enthusiastically signed the Free School Law, as it became known, on January the 15th, 1825. Outside of New England, it was the only tax-supported public school system in the whole country. And it was consistent with the Jeffersonian democratic philosophy. And I want to read you the preamble to the bill. Remember that this was drafted by a 29-year-old, just recent veteran of a terrible war. But it's it's not language that I would propose we embrace today. It's a little archaic. But it's timeless, and I think it still sings all these many years later. He said, "To enjoy our rights and liberties, we must understand them. Their security and protection ought to be the first object of a free people. And it is a well-established fact that no nation has ever continued long in the enjoyment of civil and political freedom, which was not both virtuous and enlightened. And believing that advancement of literature always has been and ever will be the means of developing more fully the rights of man, and that the mind of every citizen of every republic is the common property of society and constitutes the basis of its strength and happiness, it is considered the peculiar duty of a free government like ours in Illinois to encourage and extend the improvement and cultivation of the intellectual energies of a whole." So we come from a long tradition of commitment to free public education dating way back to the beginnings. And I'd just like to add another quote from Abraham Lincoln. We always do this, but we want to set our paths on developing something that we can all stand behind and be proud of. And according to Abraham Lincoln, you cannot fail if you resolutely determine that you will not fail. So I think that's how we would like to go forward today. So now I'm pleased to introduce our external speakers, Mr. Chair. We're joined by three remarkable individuals today who we've requested to come and give their insights, but also to provoke our thinking in terms of these major issues going forward. First, we have Dr. Stanley Eikenberry, Professor Emeritus, President Emeritus, Education Policy, Organization and Leadership in the College of Education, Urbana. Stan, as I said, also carries the title of Emeritus President, as he served as the 14th President of the University of Illinois and was responsible for major consolidations of the campuses of the university that we enjoy today, with a foresight that created our system. He served as President of the American Council of Education from 1996 to 2001, devoted to ensuring high quality educational programming at institutions throughout the US. Stan, it's wonderful to have you back participating in this. Next is my dear friend and colleague, Dr. Shirley Malcolm, who is the head of the Directorate of Education and Human Resources Program for the American Association for the Advancement of Science. This directorate includes programs in education, activities for underrepresented groups, and public understanding of science and technology. Shirley has chaired a number of national committees addressing education reform and access, serves on several boards, many boards, and was a member of the National Science Board in addition. In 2003, Dr. Malcolm received the Public Welfare Medal of the National Academy of Sciences, which is the highest award given by the Academy. It's hard to get into the Academy. It's hard to win any award in the Academy. It's impossible to win the Public Welfare Medal. So we're delighted to have you here representing so many things. And Shirley is the holder of no less than 16 honorary degrees. So thank you for the time you're going to spend with us. We're looking forward to your comments. Finally, we're joined by Mr. David Coleman, President and Chief Executive Officer of the College Board. In this role, David guides the overall direction and strategic priorities of the College Board, with the goal of ensuring all students in our care are prepared to successfully complete college and career training. Upon joining the College Board, he made it a priority to expand access to college for minority and low-income students who demonstrated college potential, with a resultant redesign that you might have read about of the SAT exam that was implemented in 2016. He's been listed in Time Magazine's 2013 list as one of the 100 most influential people in the world, and is well suited, I know from our personal interactions, to stimulate our conversations on the sustainability of our intrinsic model in public higher education here at the University of Illinois System. So thank you all for joining us. We look forward to your thoughts and the discussions that they will surely spark. And we'd now like to each of you to provide some opening thoughts about the topic area in 7 to 10 minutes each. And we'd like to start with Stan Eikenberry, if we may.
Well, thank you very much. It is a pleasure and a delight to be back. I'm honored to have been invited, and not only to join this great body, but two such esteemed colleagues to my left. So thank you very much for the opportunity. I thought I might begin very quickly by asking seeing where we really were on the question of excellence and integrity. Could I see a show of hands in the audience? How many of you, basically at the end of the day, are in favor of excellence and integrity? opposed, same sign. Well, I yield my... Oh, okay. So I thought we probably would come together on that point. Both of these are core values, and they're not unique to higher education. They are core values really for the broader culture in which we operate, but they are especially relevant and vibrant within the academic community, and they're interrelated. They're joined, if you will, at the hip, because you can't have really one without the other. Especially, you cannot have excellence in the absence of integrity. And a breach of integrity immediately just blows a hole right through any semblance of excellence. The other interesting thing is, yes, these are both fundamental values, but they are of value in their own right, if you get my distinction. The students that we recruit, the faculty members that we recruit, the programs that we offer have value to the university itself and to the society. And therefore, we're not just believing in something, we are living something and gaining from something that if we were to lose it, for example, consequences would be disastrous. So there are at least two ways to look at this. The other thing I thought I would bring up in these literally a few minutes is that excellence is actionable. Integrity is actionable. We work toward excellence and we live with integrity by human behavior, by decisions that we make, by actions that we take. These are not abstract concepts. They are actionable, tangible things that we do or that we decide or don't decide. So you're right, Tim. I was self-congratulatory enough to cite UIC as one such turning point where you grasp an opportunity hoping that it will turn out right. I listed three of these. You will note that all three were incredible successes. I didn't mention three or four or 20 or 30 that weren't so terrific. But that is also part of excellence is being willing to accept risk in order to have the reward of accomplishment. So if we all are in favor of excellence and integrity, why are they sometimes so difficult to achieve? They ought to be easy, shouldn't they? But what are the barriers to excellence and integrity? I think there are two, in my experience at least. The biggest barrier to excellence in particular is complacency. That is complacency in two extremes. One is obviously we're excellent. We just look how great we are. And the other is at the very opposite end of the scale. Woe is me, poor is me. It's okay for me to live, to survive, and not to aspire and climb. So complacency, I think, is probably the biggest of these dangers. The other thing I think that needs to be mentioned is a barrier is achieving excellence and living integrity is hard. It can be difficult, particularly integrity. I could share with you some examples of challenges to integrity that were really hard and painful. And ultimately survivable. But the reason that, you know, we aren't all excellent across the board is partly due not just to complacency, but the fact that it's hard work. And you have to make sacrifices and choices, and you have to accept some level of personal risk sometimes in terms of integrity to do the things that your conscience tells you is right. I can't help but mention the damage that the loss of integrity has done to some institutions we all know quite well. And there's no need to pick on them, but USC, for example, Stanford, rowing coach, you know, tweaking an admissions case for $500,000 that he didn't want for himself, but for the rowing program, for the aquatics program. Penn State had a huge integrity issue. Michigan State, and the damage that one of these incidents can have, not just on the reputation, but on the actual sense of excellence and integrity and soundness of the institution itself. I want to say just a quick word about integrity.
You're good.
Okay. I asked Dee Dee to be my mentor because I am not known for staying within time limits. But what really is integrity? That's worth thinking about. Is integrity following the rules? I think it is. But is that basically it? Or if it isn't the complete it, What is integrity? And I don't know the answer to that, but I think the discussion groups might have some fun talking about that issue. I think it has to do also with civility. I think it has to do with humanity and humility, empathy. Compassion. I'm not sure where those boundaries are, but I think thinking about integrity is thinking needs to be thought of more broadly than simply I followed the rule book. yes, you followed the rule book. But there's, I think, more to it than that. Let me, just one quick word on evidence. Evidence calls, excellence calls out for evidence. Not public opinion, not even scholarly opinion, but it calls out for evidence in the research sector. We have the evidence of the laboratory and we have the evidence of peer review teaching, which may be the most critical life transformational function a university performs. Got it.
That
1 minute. That may be the but not just making a claim of excellence and integrity, but having the evidence to guide where to go beyond. Thank you very much for that opportunity to take an initial shot.
Thank you, Dr. Eikenberry. Our next speaker will be Dr. Malcolm.
I knew that when I sat next to Stan, I would be in the presence of greatness, so I'm good seat. I'm very pleased to be here. I really want to talk about building healthy relationships across campus, but starting from a personal standpoint. You heard a little bit about my professional career. What Tim didn't tell you is that I was born and raised in Birmingham, Alabama. And that was in 1946, Birmingham, Alabama. And so that means that I spent my entire time in school basically being taught by people who were black, with other kids who were black. It was a totally segregated environment. We had real challenges with regard to getting the resources that we need. So you ought to be surprised then, way that I'm sitting here as a person who came out of science, who comes in with that background. I'm a post-Sputnik kid. When this all happened and the Sputnik went up and everybody says you're going to math and science, well, the first thing is they started teaching it. And then all of a sudden you realize, well, I like this, I'm good at this, and therefore there's an opportunity here for you. I could not, however, go to my state's flagship institution. I could go, but it wouldn't have been a very good idea. So I ended up going to the University of Washington. Now, those of you who can imagine 1963 University of Washington, it wasn't very diverse at all. As a matter of fact, that was the first time I had ever lived with someone who was not black, went to class with someone who was not black, ever being taught by someone who was not black. And the University of Washington had a very small African-American population. And I say this because you need to understand that most rooms I entered, I integrated. And therefore, I look at this experience now, and for me, the experience of going to the University of Washington was totally transformative. I had an opportunity not just to begin to continue to see the world in terms of black and white, but I could see other racial and ethnic groups. I began to see people from other cultures. My whole world expanded, and therefore I was able to really do my studies in the, and it was hard because I had a lot of catching up to do, but I was able to do my studies in the context of really expanding as a person and growing as an individual and learning about myself because I learned about all these other individuals. Now I say that because today's students, many of them are still coming from segregated schools. And the students that you receive in college, in many cases, are coming from institutions that have been under-resourced. So what do you do in those kinds of situations? How do you build the kind of environment that is supportive of this, that basically is forgiving of the fact that they didn't have the best preparation, but not to the extent of saying you're not going to be the best when you leave? And so this notion of how does an institution basically conform in such a way as to be able to make opportunity real, I think that's really what we're talking about, because the relationships come out of much of this. The idea of living, experiencing life in diverse environments. And our colleges and universities often provide the first opportunity for students to actually live and operate in a diverse learning community. And so under those kinds of circumstances, then what then do they encounter? So the question is that, at least in my field of STEM, is some of the most unforgiving, and that is that they can sometimes encounter implicit and explicit bias. And that is from their peers as well as from the faculty. How do you begin to understand and work with those things so that you can overcome those? Not just on the campus and in the classes, but in the majors and in the living community. How do you begin to address many of these issues? How do you help them really learn from each other, not just how to solve that calculus problem, but what is life like in this skin? And begin to help them grow as people who can contribute to a diverse workforce, because by the time they get there, it's going to be even more diverse. So the issue then becomes one of preparing people not just to make a living, but to have a life in a diverse environment where they can basically take advantage of the opportunities that are here. So the question becomes one of student-peer interactions, student-faculty interactions, faculty-faculty interactions, because the same kinds of, we're all operating in this setting right now where we're receiving these messages that if in fact you look like me, you probably don't know that much. It's hard to be taken seriously. Your scholarship may be called into question. So all of these things are still in play. And so trying to work through those really is a real challenge. Right now, one of the biggest issues that we're trying to work with as a society and as higher education is that of harassment, especially sexual harassment. And so our efforts around harassment, it's not just anti-harassment that we need. We need pro-civility. And those are different kinds of things. And so the question really is, what kinds of pro-civility efforts can one put in place and activities that one can put in place? A recent Academy report, which I really refer to you, I think that everybody needs to look at it, talked about five factors that create conditions under which sexual harassment is likely to occur. And it talks about perceived tolerance for harassment. Now, if you're perceiving tolerance for harassment, the only way you can overcome that is leadership for civility. You not tolerating harassment. And there's nothing else that you can do except those things in order to address the issue of perceived tolerance. An environment where men outnumber women, which is what happens in many of our STEM fields, and where the leadership is male-dominated and or the jobs are seen as are considered atypical for women. I am as atypical as you can get, and I know this. But the point is that should not affect my ability to go into a community and both listen and be heard. And so these notions of how do we train people to interact in ways that are respectful and that, in fact, where you are heard. And I do think that those kinds of things are really important. The third condition is hierarchical power structures. Now, I don't think you get much more hierarchical than these places. But there's another component to it, and that is where you have strong dependencies on those at the higher levels. As is often the case where with regard to a major professor or a graduate an advisor and a graduate student trainee. And those kinds of relationships and of unequal power, the unequal power dynamics of those kinds of relationships. Symbolic compliance with the law. yes, it's necessary to comply with the laws such as Title IX or Title VII, but necessary is not sufficient. And so the notion is you gotta go beyond what the law requires. You really need to look at what the people require and what kinds of safe environments that they in fact need in order to support what happens to them. And the last element that he talks about is uninformed leadership. Now, I'm not looking at this board of regents and saying that, because I serve on a board of regents. I wouldn't want that to actually happen for me. But the issue really is one of if you are not clear in terms of your statements about what you tolerate and what you expect, then that's a problem of leadership. And so the need to really be clear and transparent, no tolerance for bad behavior, but there are things that can be done, bystander training. Since everyone must take responsibility for helping to create this healthy environment, then the issue is, what is my contribution to that? For the faculty, it may in fact mean the way that I teach, the way that I interrupt a student who may in fact be disrespectful to another student and say, no, we're not gonna have that here. Let's talk about what the situation really is. Giving specific training, giving specific things that people can do, taking on the responsibility for each other, creating community and a sense of belonging. Please tell me when I need to stop. 1 minute, okay. I think that the issue of having the legal aspects sometimes get in the way, because we focus so much on those, on the things that we have to do, that we don't pay on the attention to the things that we ought to do. And the notion of actually having a society where we are able to be our best selves and to become our best selves. And that is not a society of excellence in the sense of where bias and where harassment and other kinds of behaviors like this get in the way of our becoming.
Thank you, Dr. Malcolm. David Coleman, up to you, too.
I have just pressed a stopwatch, Deirdre. So any need for your intervention? I really just want to start. People often say they're honored to be somewhere, but while President Clean asks us to be timeless, I just want to say on this day, where the country again demonstrates its inability to be civil and to be so divided, I'm so awed at your guys' day jobs, honestly, that the university is the place where we put aside our self-segregation, where you actually dare to bring together students from very different places and insist that they live and learn together. And I think it's amazing work. And I think it is one thing to demand that we produce civility at any time is a deep virtue to attain. At this time in our country, it is audacious and beautiful. So thank you for your work. And I hope anything I say may only help you in that beautiful work. And it's great to try to support it here. And the other reason I'm glad to be here, if it's okay, is putting Midwest modesty aside for a moment, and hopefully not giving into complacency, I think the University of Illinois is on a tear. I think you are in a very strong position. And I actually think to misunderstand, to not recognize what a distinctive role you could play in leading this sector, with the financial strength you have gained, with the recent investments you've achieved, with the recent buildings, congratulations, with the force behind you. And I think a Midwestern region and a country that is looking for leadership, my greatest fear and the reason that I'm here is that you take this opportunity to go as far as you might. I think you have a very special moment ahead of you. And what I want to do is do two things. I want to say a few words about how I faced that kind of opportunity when I came to the College Board as president 6 years ago, and then suggest, President Clean, respectfully, four draft principles that would meet your standard of being timeless, unifying, and just as suggestions, not that you might seriously do them, but maybe just as examples around my area, which is environment and financial stability. So when I got to the College Board 6 years ago, we were founded with what was perhaps, in some history, and one that I love, an act of remarkable self-criticism and idealism. That is, universities admitted that the way they're recruiting students was not okay, that they're drawing from a very small pool from networks that they knew. And they themselves insisted on developing an exam that would open that up to a wider set of merit. But when I became president, there were very few people in this country who looked at me and said, congratulations on leading an institution that continues to not just recapitulate inequality, but disrupt it. That was not how the College Board was seen. The College Board was seen as certifying the inequalities that already exist in our society, to be blunt. And in my view, we had to stare at that. And we were financially strong, but in a sense, brokenhearted. And I think part of that was that the what, when, and how of the SAT were all wrong. What was wrong with the what was wrong with the test itself and what it measured? A notion like SAT words was wrong. The idea that knowing the most obscure words that you likely shall not know and shall not see again is the road to college was never a good idea. And in an increasingly diverse country, it was a source of intimidation. In the new SAT, it instead measures the words you're most likely to use in the first year of college. The standard for what is in mathematics is no longer that the problems are tricky and will surprise you, but rather exactly the mathematics most often used in the first year of college. You should never have done anything to prepare for the SAT. In other words, to do high school and then do the SAT on the side was always a bad idea. Your core work in high school should be distilled in the SAT, and anything you do should not be for the test itself, but in support of a few capacities you will use over and over again to succeed in college. So the what was wrong. The when was interesting wrong. How many of you took an SAT or ACT on a Saturday? Could you just raise your hands? Sure. Interestingly, that's all wrong. Sorry you weren't qualified, President Kleinite. He's from another country, as you may know. But when you ask students to choose for themselves to take an exam on a Saturday, many qualified students count themselves out. They don't go. So what we did is we moved the SAT from an optional thing on a Saturday to something that happens in the school day, throughout Illinois today, throughout Chicago. That intervention alone, that nudge of making it not a choice, where all the forces you describe stop students, the horrors of what students do to themselves is another part of what you're talking about, Dr. Malcolm. 10% more apply to college because they see in themselves a new power. It's a very strange thing. And the third thing is how. When, not on a Saturday, but how. The perception that expensive test preparation had utterly corrupted the idea that the SAT tested merit and instead tested whether you had access to special resources. And for too long, the College Board looked at that world and said, test prep doesn't matter. And we were the only people who believed that. And instead, what I said as president was, you know, rather than this kind of like, we made a great test, it's not our fault, this test preparation industry, we said instead, while it may not be our fault, it is our problem. That is, it was our problem that this had emerged, and we hence partnered with Khan Academy to provide the best of free test preparation for the world. The students enrolled in Khan Academy today are 4 times the size of all commercial test prep in this country combined. If I had longer, I would try to describe to you how important it is that adolescents find that they can own their future through improvement. I don't really care that they get better scores, which they do, but that self-agency is so important. And finally, I think we need a new humility. While we've changed the SAT, we have to admit too often it is a veto on students with lower scores who may have achieved so much. And quite controversially, we've introduced a tool that you may have heard of. It was called an adversity score that was wrongly named. But the blunt idea of it is you must see achievement in context, that you cannot discount someone on any single score alone, but you must look at what they were given and what they have achieved to see their promise to attend universities such as yours. And the great research behind that tool shows that even students with lower scores in the most adverse environments, in fact, do succeed when admitted, if we get those balances right. So that's some of what we've done. And I could talk a little bit more about that, but I'm watching the clock, so I'm going to just move quickly to principles for you. I think as you move into this next phase, my area, the area you've asked me to talk to you about today, is environment and financial stability. So I want to offer a global principle for your consideration as you embark on these next few years of such promise in the design of the university in the future. Every advance in the environment and financial stability of the University of Illinois should advance the environment and financial stability of the families in Illinois first and throughout this country. In other words, they should be inseparably intertwined. That's the governing principle. Let me give you four examples. When I look across the table at the leaders of the diverse institutions of Chicago, Springfield, and, of course, Champaign-Urbana, what's so exciting is how you represent the full range of the towns, cities, and smaller rural environments that this country lives in. So would one principle be, we will build an infrastructure of visible value to the citizens of this state and beyond, regardless of how small the place they live is. At a time when rural America is losing its faith in college, will you in your next chapter restore it by being a visible source of value throughout communities that are smaller, in small towns, as well as in cities? Can you use your power of being represented, because it's not only the three institutions, but of course you have outposts in almost every area of this state. At a time of Brexit, at a time when Brazil, at a time when globally the rural-urban divide is paralyzing our society, can you break through that by building an infrastructure that extends throughout the environment right around you and then more globally? Number two, can you advance your own financial stability and strength while making a breakthrough in the financial stability of families? I think that higher education needs to understand the terror with which middle-class families are increasingly seeing bills that come close to $100,000 a year. And that's where it's headed. So that's hard. There are no easy answers here. It is very hard if certain kids are subsidizing others politically and socially. I don't think online courses or other tricks are going to massively change the course curve. So if you're going to do something remarkable for the University of Illinois, you must somehow secure a reasonable financial proposition for families and their financial stability. I'll offer one of many objectionable ideas, which I'm kind of used to, so if it angers anyone of faculty or the provosts here, I apologize in advance. I think the University of Illinois should make the first superb three-year degree, a degree that is seen as better than many four-year degrees. Please understand me. I don't see this as narrowly pre-professional. I see it as a new modesty. My degrees happen to be in philosophy and English literature. They are as useless as they can be. But we should ask ourselves, are you really a philosophy major if you take 15 versus 10 courses? These numbers are not magical. Can we reconsider a superb, I do not mean to diminish the residential experience, I mean to enliven it. I mean to rethink industrial structures and year-long learnings in ways, because something needs to happen to change the finances of family, or colleges cannot thrive financially without families thriving. Number three, can you show the power of college to prepare for changing jobs, not just for jobs? I think the stupidest discussions about higher education in this country surround career readiness. The idea that most college courses prepare you for a given job is silly. There are a few highly technical jobs for which this is true. Around the table, those of us in business and other areas, it's foolish. The best way to train for a job is to get a job. Being in a classroom before it is not that powerful. So what is college's relation to ideas, to jobs, to careers? It is a set of flexible powers that prepare you as those jobs change. It is the command of data. It is the command of technology. We at the College Board are working on a project for all students to gain the command of two codes before they leave high school. The code of our Constitution, a flexible, powerful document that you drew on in your opening remarks, and that of technology and data. With just those things, can we show the power that young people or older students equipped with those can have? We need to change the conversation about college and jobs to show flexible powers. And finally, number four, in this next phase of the University of Illinois, can you deliver significant breakthroughs to the environmental sustainability of this world and your state? That is, can you be the force, because it won't be private sector companies alone, that figures out what we really do about carbon, what we do about some of the big questions, sustainable approaches to healthcare that survive rural and urban environments and help them thrive? Can you make technical and practical breakthroughs in the next stage of your journey that transform the sustainability of the infrastructure around you? I think if in these types of principles we are constantly alert to the simultaneous achievement of your strength and the strength of those around you might advance you. Thank you so much for your attention.
President Clean. Would you please introduce our facilitators?
Yes, thank you. Thank you for three wonderful setups for what comes next at our breakout sessions. So we have facilitators I'd like to introduce, and the facilitators for group one, which will consider a culture of integrity and excellence. And maybe you could stand up and wave as I call your name, Terry Weaver. Is Terry and Wojciech Czartoryski, who's over there. Those two are the leaders for group one, and they meet in Thompson Rooms B and C,
here,
which is right here. Group two will be discussing fostering healthy relationships across our campuses, and our external discussants will obviously be at these appropriate sessions. And the facilitators for that group are Amalia Pallares, Associate Chancellor, Vice Provost for Diversity at UIC, and Robin Carr, Professor of Law, UIUC. And group two will gather on the first floor in the Centennial Room where we had lunch. And then the final group, group three, will be considering ensuring environmental and financial sustainability. And the facilitators for that discussion will be Bob Wilson, behind me, and Adriana Crocker, Professor of Political Science at UIS and a current Presidential Fellow. Stand up, Adriana, so that you, yeah, so that people know who to follow. And this will be in Thompson Room A.
Next door.
That's next door. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. President. We will reconvene the board meeting at 3:20, and each group will then have 10 minutes to share their prioritized responses. At this time, please head to your working groups for discussion. This public meeting is now in recess.